This episode contains curse words. If you listen closely, you will hear them.
My dad used to tell me, well, humans did have tails. You had a tail and we'd cut it off when you were a baby.
Has your dad ever told you something that you suspected might not be entirely true?
My father claims that he invented the joke, "That's what she says."
My dad has a hypothesis about melon, which is that you must eat it alone or leave it alone.
He doesn't want to get cremated because he thinks that you might be able to feel it.
Look, this is just an observation, but dads seem to harbor an unusually high number of unsubstantiated theories. You know, untested but firmly held hypotheses. So, in honor of Father's Day, we are investigating your old dad's tales. And I know you know what I'm talking about.
I've certainly heard a lot of fathers say a lot of bullshit. Does that count?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
This is Adam Mansbach, father of two. You probably know Adam from his dad-related literary work.
As the author of a best-selling fake children's book called Go the F*** to Sleep. You know, like most things with F*** in the title, it's not actually intended for children.
You wrote the dad lie version of a children's book.
Yeah.
So I need your expertise, Adam. As a non-dad myself and factually tethered person, I'm hoping you can help me understand how and why dads have turned lying into an art form.
Oh yeah, there's no one better qualified than me.
Okay, so here's the data we're working with. We asked listeners to call in with their old dad's tales. We sorted them by subject matter. And our first finding was that 24% of these dad claims were health related.
I'm not surprised.
That dads like to offer unsubstantiated health advice?
Yeah, like the fundamentals of nutrition and health are widely available to all of us. That blend of authority and ignorance seems very on brand, you know?
Okay, so here's one from Kate.
So my dad, when I was little, convinced me that if you ate peanut butter out of the jar, you would choke on it.
We did fact check this claim with dietitian Tamara Duker-Freiman.
Okay.
So I'm not saying it's impossible to choke on peanut butter out of the jar, but it is not de facto that eating peanut butter out of the jar causes choking.
What would make it a choking hazard?
So I think it has to do more with just like the amount of peanut butter per mouthful.
Right. If you're eating it with a soup spoon.
Or like a ladle.
That's where you get into a danger zone.
Exactly.
All right. Here's another one. Natalie called and said that her dad says that a glass of water will solve any problem you have.
If you're tired, drink a glass of water. If your stomach hurts, drink a glass of water. And even when my sister was in intensive care with blood clots, said, "Let's get out of here. You just need to drink more water."
Did she listen?
No.
That's probably for the better.
So will a glass of water solve any problem you have?
I'd hesitate to say any problem, but I mean, there's certainly many problems that water can be helpful for. So for example, you know, liquid empties the stomach. So if your food's repeating on you and you're just feeling like, ugh.
What does it mean to repeat on you?
To reflux, to come back up. It's how my grandmother referred to reflux. It's repeating on me. Not so sure about the blood clot.
My dad has a superstition that you can't eat two bananas. If you have more than one banana in one day, you'll get sick.
So I think what's probably behind that particular dadderstition is a fear of having too much potassium.
How many bananas would you have to eat to die of potassium overdose?
You know, to even meet your daily potassium needs through bananas alone, I mean, you're talking about probably like a dozen or more large bananas. I can't even envision a scenario where you could eat enough bananas to poison yourself.
Adam, as a professional dad, does this banana claim point to any bigger trends in dad lies?
Yeah, there's a beautiful and I think typical lack of actual specificity. You know, like bananas are all different sizes. It's not like a number of ounces of banana.
Right.
It doesn't stand up to even the most rudimentary questioning.
I know, but you wouldn't imagine. I mean, this lie persisted a long time.
So me and my sister grew up our whole lives thinking you could never eat more than one banana. And then when we reached our 30s, we saw someone eat two bananas, and we were stunned.
Okay, next finding from our survey. The second most popular subject matter for dad lies is perplexing.
Okay.
12% of our calls were about birds. Here's one from Kelly.
When I was little, I was feeding the ducks and geese, and one of the geese attacked me and bit me.
Why did the goose bite her? Kelly's dad told her it was because she was wearing white, and the goose mistook her for bread.
Wow.
And she, too, hung on to this lie for years.
She was like, I'm going to a pond, and so I have to wear, like, dark colors?
Yes.
In high school, was in the park with one of my friends, and we were over by the ducks and the geese, and I told her to watch out. We should probably not go so close because she was wearing white.
We fact-checked this with birder Amar Ayash.
I highly doubt that it thought she was a big piece of bread.
We had another goose-related dad assertion that I'm hoping you can help us with, Amar.
Sure.
This one's from Meredith in Toronto.
He sat me down and said, did you know that Canada geese used to fly in different letters?
Like not only a V formation.
Like A and B and C.
But everything but the V is like really rare?
Sometimes they'll fly in a straight line, but that's pretty unusual.
So they'll do an I, lowercase I.
Sure.
Okay, here's another one from Patrick. This one was about seagulls.
My dad would tell me that if I took a pepper shaker and threw pepper on a seagull, that the seagull would sneeze and it would slow the seagull down long enough for me to catch it.
Amar, does pepper induce a sneeze that would cause muscle paralysis in seagulls?
No.
Adam, the question this leaves me with is, why birds?
Like, why are birds the focus of so much inanity?
Dad inanity.
Dad inanity. Well, you know, to a certain extent, the controlling factor here is like, what do kids ask about? And if you're in the city, they're sort of like, they're present but elusive, right? Like, if you make up some bullshit about a bird, like, you're never going to get close enough to that bird to, like, test it out. Whereas if I was like, yo, if you pour hot sauce on a dog, it'll turn into a unicorn, like, I would pretty quickly be proven wrong.
Well, where is this drive coming from in dads?
The general propensity to bullshit their kids?
Yes.
I think it comes down to this idea that you're supposed to have all the answers. And I think that's why ultimately we bullshit as much as we do, is to preserve this fundamental bedrock lie that we are all knowing.
Uh-huh. That may account for many old dad's tales, but not every one. Hi, Dad.
Is that my daughter?
That is Marisa, your daughter, your only daughter.
My only daughter.
Yeah. There's one last class of dad claims that centers on being the first unlikely originator of something. We call this category of dad lies the founding father.
My father thinks that he is the one who brought bell bottoms to America.
The patient zero of bell bottoms in the United States.
Is my father. According to my father.
Yes, and I have to correct some of the things that she said.
That's Dad Nicholas disputing his daughter, Marisa.
Let me explain it. In 1962, I was in the south of France after graduating from high school. I figured that was the best place to go to meet girls. And people were wearing bell-bottom trousers, you know, designed bell-bottom trousers that you could buy for very little money when you hung out at the beach in Cannes.
Nice life, Nicholas.
Yeah, really.
First of all.
Yeah, it was very cool. So I you know, wore these trousers, liked them. They were, you know, beach wear, really. Very brief bathing suits, by the way, you know, banana hammocks.
Which I would like to note, my father wore Speedos until I was quite old.
You didn't seem scandalized by banana hammocks.
I wasn't, no.
Okay, so Nicholas, you're on the beach. You're wearing your bell bottoms.
Then I went to Paris. I had a pair of dark bell bottoms, but I came back to America. It was, you know, 1963, and I wore them around New York. And I noticed a lot of people asked me, where'd you get those? You know, if I were riding the subway, somebody would say, oh, I really like those pants. Where'd you get those? I was on the street a couple of times. People stopped me, more than a couple of times.
To get any comment at all in New York is out of the norm.
It's way out of the norm. And the fact it did happen very often. My friends also thought they were cool. As far as I know, I was the only one in my group that knew about them, had ever seen them before.
Hmm. Then you went to Vietnam, and when did you get back?
I got out in 68. But when I got out, everybody in New York, every guy, was wearing bell-bottom trousers.
Was your name sewed in on the label?
It should have been, I think.
So to sum up, you first slipped bell bottoms on your legs in 1962. You wore them in America in 1963. To your knowledge, you were the only person wearing them in America. Then in 1968, when you returned from Vietnam, they were all the rage. Your theory is that you brought bell bottoms to the United States.
It isn't that I brought it to the United States. Let's just say I was a carrier. You know, it could have been me and a few other people who I never saw.
I'd like to say, for the record, you have never claimed these other people existed.
Well, I never met them, so I didn't know if they existed or not.
I also have to say that when Mom and I ever said to you, Nicholas, you for sure did not bring bell bottoms to this country, you are always very insistent that you were the first one to wear them in America.
Well, you used to kid me about it because you never really believed it.
Because it was ridiculous. Because it's not a real thing.
Marisa, we're in the business of investigating these claims. We will get to the bell bottom of it after the break. We are investigating a fascinating potential dad lie.
Well, we call them embellishments.
So to figure out whether, Nicholas, you brought bell bottoms to the United States, we called an expert.
I'm a fashion historian.
Oh, well, good.
Her name is Emma McClendon. And first of all, we asked her if she knew of you, Nicholas.
No, I have not heard of him.
But that could mean, you know, that could mean a number of things.
Yeah.
So here's where the history begins, according to Emma.
So the story of bell bottoms starts actually with naval uniforms.
Naval bell bottoms date back to the 1800s.
Their design is functional. They're wider at the bottom to make it easier to roll your pants up, supposedly when you're swabbing the deck or when the deck gets wet or anything like that.
You could just roll them up because of those big cuffs.
Oh, wow. Ah.
So they start as Navy uniforms. When do they become dry land apparel?
I mean, the 1960s is really the time period when you first start to see them become civilian wear.
And Emma says there are two vectors that bring bell bottoms to the masses. This is one.
The hippies were using clothing to protest the kind of post-war consumerism and disposable culture that they saw growing up around them.
And that included buying secondhand sailor pants from Army-Navy stores.
So they patch them and embroider them and personalize them. And
No. You see, you're already going into the kind of hippie costume, yeah. These bell bottoms were not a Navy surplus.
Your bell bottoms.
They were fashion. They were cut that way.
Nicholas, keep your flared pants on. Remember, there are two vectors. And you intersected with the other one, the Euro bell bottom, which were coming onto legs at the same time as those first hippie bell bottoms. But these Euro bell bottoms were being made by designers.
Teenage consumers and younger consumers are beginning to be a very important market.
And the youths liked a flared pant, apparently. So, Nicholas, so far your story is matching up, but I think the key to your assertion is the timeline. Does wearing them in 1962 in Europe and 1963 in America put you in a position to be a key influencer for bell-bottom culture here.
1962 is just very early for bell-bottoms of any kind.
Nicholas, you could have very well been one of the first few people wearing bell-bottoms.
Well, that's good. But there's another thing that I learned.
Wait. Just take a second. How many years have we joked about this? And a historian has just told you that you may very well be at the very beginning of this. Does that validate anything for you?
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. I mean, does it validate anything for you is what I wanted to know.
No, I think it's impressive.
Yeah, bell-bottoms didn't reach their heyday until 10 years later in the early 1970s. Here's Emma.
The fact that he's an early adopter is a big deal. This is not an insignificant claim.
However, we fact-checked your bolder claim, the one that you haven't
really
so much stood behind in this interview, but you have subjected your daughter to for decades of her life.
Tortured her, I'm sure.
Yes.
Which is that you personally brought bell-bottoms to the United States, that you are bell-bottom patient zero. Here's what Emma said to that.
I would not give him that label because I just don't think any fashion phenomenon can be pinned down to an individual person.
I concede to that. I think that is very reasonable.
I mean, to me, that sounds like no one can ever be patient zero. So really, you're like pretty close. Like that was pretty, I feel like that's as closest as we're ever going to get. Yeah, I'm impressed.
Well, I feel somewhat vindicated. But not, it's not the most important thing, but it's a good.
No, it's not at all.
It's a good Father's Day present.
Yeah, this is your Father's Day gift. This is it.
Adam, as the preeminent parenting expert in this room currently speaking on this podcast.
Sure.
I have to ask you, how do moms get in on this? How do we make lying equal opportunity? Because that is the world that I want to live in.
Oh, I think we live in that world.
Great. I would like to start honing this skill right away. Do you have any advice for me on how I can develop my dad lying practice?
I would say that you should start by lying to whatever children are around.
Okay.
Perhaps you have nieces, nephews, neighbors with kids, friends with kids. Try to really hone your skills around these kids.
Mm-hmm.
Even if a kid asks you what time it is and it's 3 p.m., tell them it's midnight with a straight face. It's muscle memory. It's like going to the gym. You know, you gotta start with that. And it gets easier as time goes on until by the time, you know, perhaps you have kids of your own, you'll be utterly incapable of telling them anything that's truthful ever.
Hi.
Hey, it's Aunt Flora.
Hi.
I have some facts that are going to blow your mind.
Every Little Thing is produced by Abraham Lincoln. There is a secret bubble bath in the back of every Taco Bell. Anyone can use it. You just have to ask. Phoebe Flanagan, Aaron Reese, Bradley Campbell, Annette Heist, Nicole Pasulka, and Doug Barron were the original members of Coldplay. Our consulting editors are Ian Chillog, Caitlin Kenny, and An Angry Bear. Scored and mixed by Dara Hirsch. Broccoli may cause hair loss, and I invented skinny jeans. Goodbye.